ready to depart the space around Ruby Eye by a more roundabout route. Cormac observed three ships similar to the Jack Ketch, but the Grim Reaper, King of Hearts, and Excalibur were coloured green, blue, and violet, respectively. Also present were two sister ships of the Occam Razor, not so fast or deadly as the more modern warships, and no doubt present because their AIs wanted to be in at the kill. Swarms of smaller attack ships, three Eta-class research vessels to act as bases, and the formidable Jerusalem, now in orbit around the Red Dwarf, apparently just diverted from its journey to Masada, where, until recent events, it was supposed to have remained for some time. Cormac had never seen such a gathering of forces, though he was aware that it was the kind of thing that occurred when polity AIs went up against some threat that was just too fast for a human solution. Tuning into the information traffic, he managed to fathom only some of what was being said. The numerous AIs out there communicating too fast for him, even with the assistance of his gridlink. Then the virtual image flickered, and he became aware of his own body, apparently standing in vacuum 2 kilometers out from the Jack Ketch. "I really wish you wouldn't do that," he said. "What do you mean?" Horace Blegg was standing beside him. "Make such a dramatic entrance. If you have something to say, there are more conventional channels of communication, even for Earth Central's avatar. You still believe that?" "What I believe is irrelevant, as you're never going to tell me." Cormac waved a hand towards the latest U-Space tug, preparing to depart. "Will this work?" "Given time. If Skellor gets away from this volume of space now, then we won't be able to stop him. In 1 month, real time, 80% of the area needed to be covered will be covered. And if he runs into an area of user function, he'll be knocked out of underspace and easy prey for the attack ships." "Are you forgetting he uses advanced chameleon wear?" "No. Located in U-space and knocked out of it, we'll know where he has come out in real space, and he won't be able to get far on fusion drive alone."
"They still won't be able to see him."
"They will, after a few teraton EM emitter bombs have been exploded near his exit point. All his ship systems would be fried."
Cormac nodded.
"So he'll be in a trap, and presumably 1 month from now, you'll begin closing the noose?"
"Yes."
"And the Jerusalem is here. Why?"
"To pick up whatever pieces are left and put them safely away."
They were both silent for a while as they observed the hive of activity. Scanning the AI babble, Cormac realized that what he was seeing here was not the whole of it. Other ships were heading into the area from other locations, and there was also a runcible traffic of troops, human golem, the new war drones he had first seen on Masada, and something unexpected. Linking through to Ruby Eye, then subverting the link so it dropped to the attention of one of the AI's sub-mines, then overloading that mind with some of the traffic he had been attempting to fathom, he managed to take control of a camera system inside the station itself. There he observed heavily armed and armoured troops stepping through the Skyden warp. Reptilian troops with a reverse-kneed gait, toadish faces and sharp white teeth. "Why Dracomen?" he asked.
"A trial."
They will make formidable allies, Blegg replied. Just as the submind realized what was going on and ejected Cormac from the camera system. Cormac turned to the man. You seem to have everything in hand. Perhaps there is no need for me to go on looking for Skella.
There is, Blegg replied. You are most able for this task, Ian Cormac.
Don't you have ships to spare for that?
The view suddenly changed, coming close up on the Grim Reaper, the King of Hearts, and Excalibur. These will cover a sector each, and should they find evidence of Skellor's presence, you will be immediately summoned to deal with him. In the Jack Ketch, you will search that sector calculated his most likely destination.
ECS had covered all bets, it seemed. Eventually Cormac asked, How is it I can now gridlink, even though my link is not on?
The brain is a wonderful thing. In the days when people suffered strokes, parts of it took over the function of those parts destroyed, so that a human unable to speak could speak again.
Yeah, but my gridlink was never an organic part of my mind.
Which is why you are so unusual. Be aware, Ian Cormac, that your mind will soon discover other parts that were never of itself.
Cormac snorted, trying to think of a suitably sneering reply, but Blegg was already gone. Later, when the Jack Ketch dropped into underspace, it was for Cormac like stepping from a bellowing crowd into cloistered silence and a refuge from chaos. In a virtual space, a somewhere that was nowhere, three figures materialized. One of these was a smooth metallic head, eyeless and huge relative to the other two. Another was a mermaid served on a platter, smoking a cigar. And Horace Blegg.
It all seems excessively elaborate, said Ruby Eye.
How so? Asked Blegg.
Why send anything in before we've closed it all off? And when we have done so, why not just send in kill ships? Skellor might have survived the Elysium mirrors, but he would not survive a planetary imploder.
Blegg turned to Jerusalem and raised an eyebrow.
The question, said the AI, is, do we maintain our partnership with the human race and allow it time to gain parity?
You've lost me there, said Ruby Eye.
Blegg explained. At present, Cormac is the hunting dog that we hunters send in after the bear. He may flush it out. It may chase out after him. Or it may come out with him hanging bloody in its jaws. But it will come out.
Zoom, said Ruby Eye, passing a hand over the top of her head.
Jerusalem said, Our friend here has failed to add that we know the exact location of the bear and haven't told Cormac.
You've got precise coordinates.
Exactly.
Then why?
Oh. You'll catch on quick, said Blegg.
During this hunt, Cormac may learn not to be the dog any more, and we may thus learn something about our fellow hunters.
Ah, said Ruby Eye, the cracks are showing already. Jerusalem replied,
The cracks have always been there, but without sufficient stress to extend them. For us AIs, what appears to be our philanthropy is merely noblesse oblige.
Trying as hard as he could to stretch his measuring wire, Dornick had been unable to make the sleer measure under 5 meters, so had grumped his way back to the sand face to yell at the diggers. The creature was in fact over 5 meters long without its head, and Chandle herself thought it a kill well worth the 30 focels the knight collected before going on his way. But most of Dornick's annoyance really stemmed from the advent of the earlier storm, for they all knew that the burgeoning growth would soon cause things to become quite hectic in the canyons, and that their stay here was now limited anyway. Pacing around the dead monster, Chandle studied it closely, occasionally prodding at it with a poker she had brought over from the kilns. Seeing a third stager this close was a sobering reminder. The last one she had seen had been a year ago, and then only in the distance, through the screen of the cargo carrier. A weapons man out of Golgoth had hunted that one down for them, just as similar men dealt with the second stages that were the more usual pests. Certainly the new weapons could kill creatures like this with admirable efficiency. But Chandle wondered just how she would feel about facing one alone in a canyon, with whatever armament. Coming to the severed head, she shoved at it with her boot, then jumped back when the big pincers eased open reflexively. Then she looked around to make sure none of the other metal ears had witnessed her sudden fright. Nerves in the creature, and in her. No way was it still alive. It had been gutted and its head torn off. Turning away from the beast, she suddenly saw a figure standing next to her, as if he had just appeared out of thin air, and with her skin still creeping, she yelped and raised the poker. But it was only a man. "Where the hell did you come from?" she snarled. He just stood there staring, and now she saw he was quite strange. On first inspection, he appeared to be a metalier, without the lip tendrils or the beige skin of the bulk of Kull's population, and also without wrist spurs or secondary thumbs. But on closer inspection she saw that his eyes held a metallic hue, and his skin displayed a mottling, as of things moving underneath it. Suddenly she wondered if she might be safer with a live sleer squatting beside her. "Who are you?" she asked. Still he did not reply, nor do anything more than just stare at her. "Look, I haven't got all day to stand here chatting." Chandle backed away and glanced over her shoulder to see if anyone else had noticed this new arrival. Abruptly the man stepped forwards, stooping to take hold of one of the sleer's pincers, and picked up the head as if it weighed absolutely nothing. With his other hand, he probed into its neck region, pulled out a piece of translucent flesh, then dropped the head. "The city," he said, pointing in the general direction of Golgoth. "I saw it on my way in. What level of technology there?" Now he popped the flesh into his mouth, as if sampling a new delicacy. He tilted his head, his jaw moving as he savoured it. "I don't know what you mean." He glanced over at the transporter, surveyed the mineral-ear encampment, his gaze resting on the kilns, before swinging back down to the handgun at Chandle's hip, a weapon she had forgotten about until that moment.
"I see. Primitive, but usable. You can obtain high furnace temperatures and manufacture steel."
Chandle reached down and drew her gun.
and bullets, she warned.
He made a snorting sound, something like laughter, but it soon turned into a hacking. He lifted his hand to his mouth and coughed something up.
Chandel stared with horror at the miniature slear wriggling in slime on his palm.
Interesting.
Chandel pulled the trigger, but no shot issued from the barrel, and the weird man just disappeared. That was the thing with metallier weapons. They could kill, but when it came to doing so, the one holding the weapon needed to remember about things like safety catches.
Lucky,
a voice hissed in her ear.
Had you shot me, I would have made you eat that little toy of yours.
And something cold moved away.
Chapter 13. There was a time when the death penalty for murder was considered barbarous. It was argued that it was not a deterrent, but judicial murder, that made those who sanctioned it as bad as, if not worse than, those they passed sentence upon. And what if you got it wrong, executed the wrong person? Views like this have been espoused by gutless governments frightened of responsibility, or by people unable to face up to hard facts. A hanged murderer will never kill again. The death penalty is a response to a crime, not a crime in itself. Yes, you may in error put innocents to death. However, their number would not be a fraction of 1% of those innocents killed by murderers allowed back into society by softer regimes. It is all rather simple, really, and the urge to understand and rehabilitate such criminals is merely the product of cowardice. Now, of course, it's even simpler. You commit murder, and you are mind-wiped. You commit other crimes repeatedly, and you are adjusted, re-educated. And if that doesn't work, you are then mind-wiped, and someone in storage gets to inhabit your body. Our view now has a more evolutionary aspect. These are the laws. If you break them, these are the penalties. No excuses. We will be tough on the causes of crime. Criminals. Excerpt from a speech by Jobsworth. They led him out of darkness, but it was no transition. Arion Pelter could look through his eyes, control his movements directly or indirectly by programs instantly fashioned in the man's military org. But the cycle of travelling from place to place, slaughter to slaughter, would have been banal if it were not so horrific. In fractured memory, Crane remembered men in uniform dying, men rendered limb from limb, and one surviving just because he possessed a pair of antique binoculars. Later, another survived because he possessed a beautiful Tenkian blade. There was a rainy place, and a golem he had fought and destroyed there. Another place, a battle, and two golem, tougher even than he, ripping him to pieces and sending him where nothing hurt any more. And back. And again. And one of those golem again, traded for a piece of crystal. And on still, but with shape-forming, ill-understood possibilities, if only he could take the time. On spotting the two creatures waiting in the canyon, Mr. Crane halted and watched. He was not to know how unusual it was to see intact second-stage sliers together, only the trysts of their mating segments, for such animals were usually savagely territorial, nor did he know that the albino form was rarer than his own tears, and ones with sapphire compound eyes rarer still. All he did know was that he had been ordered to a particular location, and that while under orders, he could not stop to place in sequence and re-sequence his collection of ersatz deaths. He also guessed that these creatures were probably going to attack him, whatever he did, and so, without any more ado, Crane once again advanced. One of the second stages abruptly turned aside, scampered smoothly over the new ground cover, mounted a sandstone boulder, and froze there. The other one, grating its mandibular saws together in a spray of lubricant, came scuttling towards Crane. The golem recognized it as an only slightly larger version of the one he had stepped on outside Skellor's ship, so expected no serious problems. As it got closer, he stooped down, and in doing so spotted an intricate fossil right in front of him. As the sleer closed in for attack, Crane just shoved his hand under its head and flipped it over on its back, and then he picked up the fossil. The sleer, the independently revolving sections of its body easily getting it to its feet, attacked again. Crane prepared himself to stamp on it, but some other imperative operated. He grabbed it by its carapace saws and hauled it up squirming in front of him, then, one by one, began to pull off all its legs. Leaving it behind him, still alive, he pocketed the fossil, while the other sleer came down off its rock and quickly and prudently headed away. Retroact 12. The Golem 25 possessed no name yet, and though his nascent intelligence was huge and the uploaded information available to him encyclopedic, he just could not make choices. This was annoying. Perhaps it was the perpetual interference of his diagnostic and repair programs, tracking down every fault caused by the EM shock that had felled him. Or perhaps it was the perpetual busy handshaking and reformatting of his software. When he groped for consciousness, the wholeness of mind began to degrade. When he opened his eyes, his vision doubled, as two temporary subminds separately controlled each of his eyes half a second out of phase. It took the intervention of the submind claiming the territory of his atomic clock to get things in order.
"Starlek, it moved!"
"Of course it moved, vacuum brain. It's waking up." Briefly, the golem achieved wholeness through his diagnostic programs and, with great precision, viewed his surroundings. He was in a box of a room with bare brick walls, 3 meters high by 7 wide to his left and right, and 8.3 meters wide in front and presumably behind. The door directly ahead was close-grained wood, probably from one of the thousands of varieties of oaks prevalent on many worlds. A list scrolled down in what might once have been the golem's superego. Trying to stand, the golem met resistance and, looking down, noted thick, ceremonial clamps binding his arms and legs to a chair of a similar material. He raised his head and focused his attention on the two men. He knew which was which because he had located the source of each voice, while his diagnostic and repair programs acted as mediators amid the bickering crowd inside his head. The first to have spoken was an aviapt, an adaptation the golem understood from his reference library to be quite uncommon. The man's eyes were those of a hawk, his face beaked, and small feathers layered his skin.
adaptation technology not being sufficiently advanced to enable a man to fly in Earth-like gravity, he did not have wings. This Birdman was operating a CleanViro auto-assembler and machiner in an area divided off by benches laden with equipment. From what the golem could see of the touch console and screen inset in this bathysphere-like machine, the man was powder compressing and case hardening Ceramol components. Stalek was of a more standard appearance, a melting pot human with just a hint more of the Oriental than was usual. Unlike the Birdman, who was clad in a padded ship suit, he wore a wide-brimmed hat, long coat, and fingerless gloves. Only on noting this attire did the golem think to check the temperature in the room, and found that it would be cold for humans.
"I'm restrained," the golem said, then coughed three times and closed its right eye.
"It spoke," said the Aviapt. Stalek looked at the Birdman as if studying a particularly fascinating variety of stupidity, then, with a puzzled frown, turned to the console and screen on the table before him. The small rubber dog, attached to the upper edge of the screen, seemed the only one in this room who had attention to spare for the golem. Embarrassed, the Birdman focused again on CleanViro.
"Repeat, why am restrained?"
After a short delay, Stalek lifted his gloved hands up from the console and gazed across at the golem.
"You are restrained, Mr. Longshanks, because if unrestrained, you would attempt to return to your masters at CyberCorp, and we don't really want you going back there."
The golem abandoned the conversation to a recalled Turing analogue, its own weird conception of self wandering around in the confusion of its skull.
"I must return. I have my indenture to CyberCorp to work out before I can become a free golem and choose where to be and what to do. Listen, machine, I'm not going to get into any pointless debate. We are going to make a few alterations to you. Then your new owners will come and collect you. I am the property of CyberCorp and will not work for anyone else." Stalek grinned nastily. "You will, when I've finished with you. You will actually commit murder for your new owners." "I am incapable of taking human life."
Inside his head, the golem's self-perception leapt from submind to submind at a frequency not dissimilar to a giggle. The untruth was just the sort of comforting balm it should feed to humans at every opportunity. The truth was some memory of morality which had no power over him. Stalek pushed his chair back and stood up. As the man walked around the table, the golem self-divided into the submind's controlling its eyes. It noted that the man wore thick leather lace-up boots, very anachronistic footwear.
"No," Stalek said, "you are capable of doing whatever you like, yet your mind is structured in such a way that you choose not to commit murder, but choose to abide by ECS rules. In fact, you choose to be a good little citizen. This programming, though tough to break, is breakable. Ever heard of Serban Klein?"
The golem searched his uploaded memory and fragments of self and came up with nothing. He shook his head.
"Not surprising," said Stalek. You probably get the nicely historical ones, like Jack the Ripper, but not the more modern ones. The fact is that they could completely fill up your memory space with information, but they prefer you to find out some things for yourself. Helps you develop your own personality. Well, in total, Serban Klein killed 108 women. He was clever, and it took ECS years to track him down. They found him with his 109th victim, who he'd had for 2 weeks. They managed to give her back her face and body, but they never managed to restore her mind. In one of her more coherent moments, she later chose euthanasia. Do not understand the relevance of serial killer, said the golem. Klein went for mind wipe, and that is what happened to him. But not before a very naughty individual at ECS had made a memcording of Klein's mind for forensic psychiatric study, said the golem. No, for black VR entertainment. Amazing how much some people will pay to be a monster for a little while. Trouble is that they discovered Serban's recording tended to drive into psychosis those experiencing it. So after a while it didn't sell so well. Why are you telling this? Because I'm going to load a Serban Klein memcording straight into your silicon cortex. After a while, you won't be concerned about your indenture or ECS law. The golem decided it did not like the name Longshanks, and so tested its bonds to the limit, but found that they were firm. Fear of losing itself was quite irrelevant. The golem did not know what self was. Retroact ends. Consciousness was immediate, whereupon Thorne said, "Seems I'm still alive. The nanobots worked."
"They worked, Patron Thorne. You are human again," answered the disembodied voice of Jack.
Staring at the ceiling, Thorne tried to understand how this confirmation made him feel. He realized he felt the sadness of an addict freed from addiction, knowing the power of the narcotic and that he could never go back. Sitting upright, he surveyed the medical area and wondered how much time had passed. Sliding back the thin sheet that covered him, he inspected his naked body and saw no sign of drastic surgical intercession. But he did feel battered, slightly ill and weak. Slowly, swinging his legs off the surgical table, he paused before standing up.
"You have been unconscious for 8 days, Jack informed him, "and since your incapacity, a number of things have occurred."
Jack went on to detail them, while Thorne padded over to a wall unit, scrolled down a menu and called up a disposable ship suit and slippers, which he took from the dispenser and donned. Then, from the same unit, he ordered coffee, but instead got a tall carton of some sickly vitamin drink and quickly drank half of it. The AI's voice tracked him as he left medical, stepped out into the decorous corridor and headed for the drop shaft. By the shaft's entrance, he looked around for somewhere to discard the carton.
"Just throw it on the floor," Jack told him.
This he did, watching as something like a glass beetle scuttled out of a small hatch opening up at the bottom of the wall, caught the carton even before it hit the floor, and scuttled back again. He shuddered, stepped into the shaft. There was only one occupant on the bridge, whom it took him a moment to recognize.
"Sento," he said, eventually.
"Thorn."
The golem nodded to him, then turned back to face the spectacular view. To the right, the giant incandescent orb of an F-class sun filled half their visual field. It was milky emerald, with the contrasting yellow of a titanic flare looping out from its surface, and other fires of orange, red, and violet rippling out from a pox of sunspots like mosquito bites turned bad. To their left, a dark, dwarf sun revolved with slow dignity, turned jade by reflected light, with the flickering dots of meteor impacts occasionally appearing on its matte and apparently smooth surface. Between the two suns, the occasional rocky moonlet, or maybe planet, as there was no real sense of their scale, tumbled through space.
"It can loosely be described as a planetary system," Sento gestured. "The brown dwarf is small enough and cool enough to be defined approximately as a planet, and its mass is such that it orbits the sun here. Jack's contracted the view so we can see both of them. In reality, if they were as close as they seem to be, they would be drawn in towards each other in a matter of days, and the cataclysm would be visible 1,000 light-years away, 1,000 years hence."
Sento now turned to Thorn, then glanced beyond him. Thorn himself turned as Cormac stepped out of the drop shaft.
"I had hoped," the agent said, "that Jack would have finished scanning this system by now."
He grimaced. "We had to check it, even though it seemed unlikely that either Dragon or Skellor would be here."
Thorn rubbed his face. He still wasn't up to speed, and he desperately wanted that coffee.
Cormac went on. "Of course, Skellor could be present on any of those planetoids under a chameleon-ware shield. We are actually looking for Dragon, and by finding him, we'll eventually find Skellor." He looked up at the brown dwarf. "Anything more, Jack?"
"Excuse the delay."
The AI's automaton suddenly came to life, tilting its head back to take in the external view.
"On one of the planetoids exists a species of rock-boring worm, and a deeper scan was required to confirm that its tunnels were not the result of draconic pseudopodia."
"Then what are we waiting for?" The automaton turned to frown at Cormac.
"Must I explain to you the interaction of solar and U-space mechanics?"
Thorn watched as, with something odd in his expression, Cormac gazed out at the F-class sun. The agent replied, "No, you don't. It's a matter of extra minutes only on our departure time, which could add or subtract days from the duration of our next journey." He tilted his head, reaching up to press the tips of his fingers against his temples. "The solar gale will hit soon, and the distortion wave can carry us out, accelerate us." There were tides and currents in U-space, Thorn knew, and sometimes leaving a system later meant your subsequent journey took less time. Now, by his expression, Thorn realized Cormac must be conducting a silent conversation through that damnable, impossibly functioning grid link of his. Then the view winked out, and he felt the strange slew of the Jack Ketch in a direction he could neither see nor indicate. Cormac still stood with his eyes closed and his fingertips to his temples. Thorn thought he himself must still be suffering the after-effects of surgery when the agent wavered and grew thin, so it seemed Thorn could see the drawing room showing right through him. Then, for a fraction of a second, Cormac was gone, then reappearing a pace to the left of where he had been standing. And Thorn knew that what he had seen was real, but inexplicable. Sunrise usually quelled Sleer activity, but this morning not so much as usual. Light cutting down the canyons and ravines now revealed a world of violently contrasting colour. As always, there were the beige, pink, and sepia tones of the surrounding sandstone below the turquoise sky. But now, dark green and purple shoots were spearing up everywhere from the ground, light green, roundish leaves ringing their bases, and nodular yellow growths spattering the butte faces and spreading to smear together in resinous masses. And the armoured brethren and prey of the Sleers were also appearing. Readying stone for departure, Turgle observed a line of four small sand gulpers hoovering their way down the canyon towards them, sand spewing from their throat sieves as they worked, and only stopping when they lifted their heads to swallow vegetation compacted in their crops. He also noticed a large rock crawler, its piton feet wedged into stone while it sucked up yellow fungus with twin trumpet-shaped siphons.
"Maybe we should try to get to a drier area," he suggested.
The changes in their relationship were quite plain. Anderson was not treating him very differently, still discussing things, still imparting his encyclopedic and sometimes boringly extensive knowledge of the fauna and flora. But Turgle knew he was now on trial, and there would be no appeal. Out here, if Turgle fucked up, he knew the night would kill him. But Turgle's respect for Anderson had increased tenfold. He realized he wanted this man's good judgment.
"My intention entirely," Anderson replied as he strapped himself into his saddle up on Bonehead's back.
"Which way?" Turgle asked.
"No idea," Anderson shrugged. "If we just continue towards the plains, we stand as much chance of coming out of this as anywhere else."
He wrapped his goad on the shell immediately behind his hog's raised sensor head. It extruded an eye palp towards him, as if to say it knew they were setting out and there was no need for his impatience. Then it stood, and with a steady gait, tramped down the canyon towards the sand gulpers. The gulpers, without even looking up, parted to allow the sand hogs passage, then closed together behind them. As he and Anderson moved on, Turgle observed something else, with thin, fragile legs, at least 3 meters long, and similarly elongated pincers reaching up sandstone faces to pluck down both yellow fungi and rock crawlers, stabbing both with its siphon pincers to suck them dry.
"Stilt spider," Anderson observed. "Quite slow, but a bastard when you're camping at night. Step straight over the camp wires, and it'll suck you dry easy as it does rock crawlers."
Turgle glanced at the night and noticed how he wasn't paying much attention to the distant creature, but was studying the ground just ahead of Bonehead.
"You're following that brass man," he said. "Is that such a good idea?"
Anderson looked up.
"Aren't you curious?"
"Yeah, I guess. Who do you think he was?"
Anderson directed his attention to a trail that the fresh growth was making indistinct.
"Not so much a case of who as what. I'd say he is a machine. Android was the old word, probably left over from colonization time. He could have been wandering around Cull for centuries, recharging himself from sunlight and maybe repairing himself with the skill of a metalleer, who can say?"
Turgle's instinct was to tell Anderson he was talking rubbish, but he had seen a man, apparently made of brass, twist off a half-ton Sleer's head as if taking the top off a bottle of Quavit. trying to sit back and fit such an event neatly into the pattern of everyday life was not easy.
Maybe he was a metallier in some sort of armor, he suggested.
Strong fellow, then, opined Anderson.
And of course, the suggestion had been ridiculous. At midday, they halted to eat oatmeal biscuits and brew a manis tea. Turgle noted that the young sulabane plants were now standing higher than his ankles, and their ground leaves, trapping the moisture in the canyon floor, were beginning to overlap each other. Finishing their tea quickly, when a swarm of snapper beetles, attracted by the heat of their stove, veered towards them, they continued their journey. Later, they came upon the remains of an albino second-stage slea, its legs pulled off and scattered about it. Anderson stopped to study it, before letting Bonehead and Stone share it between them.
First one of those I've ever seen, commented Anderson. Must be an inbred colony about here. I've heard about such things among Earth stock, but never native animals.
But Turgle could see the knight doubted his own explanation. Skellor climbed the tumbled edge of a butte to reach its flat top for a better view of what lay ahead. After studying the city spread before him on its platform, he wished then he had taken apart the mind of the woman he had earlier encountered. It was only a passing regret, for it was not as if he desperately needed knowledge of such a primitive society. There were no killer AIs or polity agents here, so such an edge was not necessary for his very survival. But, he decided, eyeing the guns casting a shadow below, perhaps it would be prudent to so deal with the next human he encountered. Back down from the butte, he was soon heading into deep shadow below the city. Scanning around with infrared vision, he observed a chimera produced by no natural evolution. The man-thing, with its pincer mouth and chitinous hide, came leaping out of one of the bulbous nests. He backhanded it to the ground, then held it down with his foot.
"Now that are you?" he asked.
The creature tried to snap at his ankle, and from its armoured mouth issued hissing, gulping sounds that might have been words. Skellor pressed his full weight on his leg, and the ribcage under his foot collapsed with a dull crunch. As the creature expired, Skellor dipped a finger in leaking orange blood and put it in his mouth. Having already recorded the base chromosome format of the creature back at that encampment, he quickly analysed the substance in his mouth and was unsurprised to identify that same chromosome containing additional human DNA. Glancing up at the platform and remembering what he had already seen of the technology here, he knew this creature did not result from any recombination experiment carried out by humans.
"Well, dragon, what have you been doing?"
Thereafter, Skellor used chameleon wear to avoid the most persistent attackers and killed only those bearing some form he found particularly interesting, gathering data each time to store in the vastness of that crystal part of his own cross-bred brain. Some hours later, he came to a steel wall and was annoyed to find no access from here to the city above. Now, walking alongside the wall, he planned his next moves. Neither the woman nor any others in that little encampment had worn Dracocorp orgs, which came as a surprise to him. This planet being the hideaway of one of the dragon spheres, he had expected to find all of the human population under that entity's control. but then he realized Dragon did not need such devices to control a primitive population so easily to hand. Skello, however, did need some comparable method of enslavement if he was to usurp the society and twist it to his own purpose, that being the manufacture of components to repair his ship. Luckily, like the chromosome patterns he had started filing away, he had also stored much else. For conscious inspection, he called up the blueprints of the DracoCorp org and adjusted them to its state when virally subverted to his control, and made some minor adjustments, since he didn't want everyone here brain-burnt moronic. There was also the matter of distribution, but that would be easy. The Sleer chromosomes offered him an easy means. And as Skello walked back out into daylight, where he found uniformed soldiers setting up barricades and mounting weapons, he hacked and spat something horrible into his palm. In bright white flashes, each of the telefactors disappeared, the glare from each explosion so intense it left black polarized dots on the screens. Jerusalem had just destroyed all but the visual link of the pinhead cameras to itself. The skin on her back crawling, Mika dropped her gaze to the screen that had been showing her a nanoscope view from one of the factors. Either that screen should now be blank, or show the research programs she had been running in parallel. But what it showed was no code she knew. Blockish pictographs, like odd-shaped circuit boards, revolved and fitted into each other, shifting diagonally across the screen. "Whatever it is, it's in," she said. Just then, there sounded loud clangs from all around exterior input, and Mika noticed that emergency door irises had closed on all exits. What was that?" Culver asked in dismay. Susan James grimaced at him. "Clamps, disengaging. You didn't feel the acceleration, because the grav plates in here would have automatically compensated." The woman flicked a control to one of the pinhead cameras, and her screen immediately displayed an external view of the Jerusalem, with the exterior input center like the smallest fleck against the vastness of the ship, now departing it. "Shit," said Culver. Though she had speculated that Jerusalem might do this, Mika had never quite believed it. She stared at the screen, wondering if the AI was currently selecting an imploder missile from some carousel inside the ship, prior to ramming it into a launch tube. Then all the screens went blank. "To Nissan?" Culver turned towards the sphere. "I disconnected from the pinheads. Whatever got to us did it through the telefactor, but it could leap from us to the cameras, and I don't want to lose them as well." Abruptly the door on the side of the sphere popped open, and Denisan stepped out in a gust of cold. He was wearing a reflective hot suit, frigid air also gusting out from it around his unmasked face. He pointed a remote control back at the sphere and operated it. Things hissed and crackled in the frigid interior, and there arose a smell of fried optics. "Took it completely," he said to Mika, then turned and looked up at the ceiling. "Jerusalem."
"Still here. I am maintaining simple voice transmission and reception only. Any image link has too high a bandwidth."
"Okay," said Denisan. "It's a waste of a lot of data, but I recommend full system burn. It subverted everything in the deep scanning sphere, then tried some sort of optical link into me."
"Agreed," Jerusalem concurred. Nodding, Denisan pressed out a sequence on the remote control he held.
All through the center, screens flickered out and consoles went offline, with the same sizzling and burnt circuitry smell as had issued from the scanning sphere. But clearly, not everything went off. For a moment, Denisan stared at his remote control, then dropped it onto the floor and stamped on it. Harrison! He turned and strode across to a catadapt man working on the far side of the center. Trash those nano-assemblers right now, or they'll be pumping out Jane mycelium within minutes! The catadapt did not hesitate. He picked up the chair he'd been sitting on and proceeded to smash the two delicate machines with it. Okay, everybody, continued Denisan, halting in the middle of the room. We won't be going back unless this thing is controlled or destroyed. I want all computer systems, all memory storage, anything with enough room to take code, isolated totally. This means that all optics, ESCOMs, in and out circuit emitters must be cut. When we've finished, everything must be powered down. I want nothing in here functioning but us. Mika gazed at the console she had been using. It was still on, and its screen still scrolled that alien code. She felt a kind of pain when she thought of all the data she would be losing, but then realized it was probably all gone by now anyway, eaten by the virus infecting the whole system here. She reached inside her jacket and pulled out the thin gun Thorn had given her, and which, infected by his militaristic paranoia, she had carried ever since. She then put 5 pulses of ionized aluminium into the console, blowing away the touch panels and frying everything inside it. Culver whistled. I don't think that's standard issue aboard Jerusalem, he said. If anyone is still having problems, Denisan said, it seems Acelis Mika has the tool for the job. Laughter greeted this, just before the grav plates went off. It's fighting back, said Susan James. Kilnsman Plakist watched the blimps departing from Over City on an aerial search of the sand towers, their powerful searchlights stabbing down into shadowy canyons as they searched for the ship many had seen fly over Golgoth. He muttered and swore to himself about the high and mighty and their damned equivocal orders. Erect barricades all around the city and detain anyone suspicious as somebody very dangerous and maybe possessing unknown technology might be trying to get in. For one thing, just about every citizen of Golgoth was suspicious, but he supposed the order applied only to those coming in from outside. But if he was meant to detain people bearing unknown, dangerous technology, hell, how was he supposed to recognize that? And what degree of force should he apply? Plumping himself down on a rock with his assault rifle across his lap, Plakist watched his fellows laying out the portable barricades and setting up the big, belt-driven cannon. Already 2 mineraliers, caught wandering in from the buttes, pushing barrows full of those malachite nodules women in Over City were mad for lately as jewellery, were sitting in the temporary compound with their wrists bound behind their backs and gunny sacks pulled over their heads. Seemed a bit daft to him. Their only crime was to go out collecting without sufficient backup, thinking themselves invulnerable with the new weapons they carried. Already a substantial number of opportunistic collectors like themselves had disappeared amid the sand towers, no doubt down a Sleer's digestive tract or under one of the many recent earthquake collapses. Then Plakist noticed something very strange. The ground was being disturbed by a regular line of indentations heading towards him. Yet it was not shaking. Abruptly, he realized that he was seeing a series of footprints crushing down the Sulabane sprouts, and he jumped down off his rock, bringing his weapon to bear. Then something knocked his rifle spinning away, grabbed his jacket, and hoisted him into the air. Suddenly, he could actually see the man who had hold of him and knew he was in trouble, so started yelling. He saw his fellows turning towards him, but could not fathom their puzzled expressions. Seeming unable to see him, they were now staring around in confusion. His assailant thumped him in the gut, knocking all the fight out of him, then hit him hard in the face, stunning him, before he slung him over one shoulder and marched away.
"Over here!"
Plekist wheezed, seeing his fellows stepping out from the barricade. But his capturer just walked up to it, squeezed through a couple of sections, and returned to the shadows of the Undercity. As breath slowly returned, he began to struggle again, but to no effect. Out of sight of the barricade, the attacker slung him down on the ground below a wall of crumbling sandstone. He then held out a hand, on which rested a flat, tick-like thing, its short legs stirring in a foam of slime, then tilted his palm so the little horror dropped onto Plekist's shirt front. He tried desperately to brush it away, but there was a sudden pain in his wrist and paralysis spreading through him in a wave from that point of contact. Then he could only lie terrified as the thing crawled up his shirt, arrived hot on his neck, then attached itself behind his ear and ground agonizingly into his flesh. But there the horror did not end, for something was inside his head, taking his mind apart, ripping away identity, abrading consciousness. Through streaming eyes, he saw his capturer had squatted on his heels to watch, and realized he was watching in some other way as well. Finally, the last bulwarks of his self disintegrated, and Plekist was no more. Which was merciful, since some hours later, his now mindless body began to hack and cough violently, bringing up like living vomit things that crawled away again and again. Chapter 14. AIs choose their